like Geraldine said, like I'm working for netzpolitik.org and writing a lot about privacy and data protection, but today I want to speak about digital human rights in general. So the first question we're asking ourselves is that why do we talk here about digital rights? Because like I think fusion is a typical time to abstain from all digital devices or like your computers at least, like people use smartphones still, but like yeah, we are all here like not to use our computer daily. But another question we have to ask us is why digital rights are different from normal human rights, or if they are different from normal human rights. And we have to also see like, wait, we also have to see like that human rights have the principle to like be valid for all people, whatever the nationality or ethnic origin or color or language is. And the same is especially valid for the internet, because like the internet is a place without borders, or at least was a place without borders. And Tim Berners-Lee, the kind of inventor of the World Wide Web, which had its 25th birthday last year, especially said this last year to the birthday of the World Wide Web that we need a charter for the World Wide Web for human rights. And we can like derive really, really many analogies to classical means of communication or classical rights we have. And like the first or like a really obvious one is like writing letters, because in former times like communication was mainly about telegrams and letters and telephone, and we all have the right to put our letter in an envelope without anyone besides like the recipient opening it. But today's like communication mainly shifts to email or instant messengers or Twitter or whatever, and so we have to see that like our mails are not in an envelope anymore, despite we decrypt it, but they are readable for everyone who is like intercepting a Wi-Fi or something, because encrypted mail still is not widely used. This legal principle, which like saves our right to like a confidential correspondence, is enshrined really in most of the countries in the world, and it was like founded for like normal forms of formal forms of communication, but then was expanded even by the UN to electronic communication on the internet, because like why should we have like different rights on the internet than in the normal world? Of course it was always that like this right to the secrecy of correspondence could be intercepted or hindered, because like lawful interception, like at least what they call lawful, is happening for really fighting serious crimes, at least they say that. Another thing that we have to keep in mind when we talk about digital communication is that in digital communication we don't only have the content of the communication, but we also have the metadata. That means that it's not only known what we are writing, it's known to whom we are writing, when we are writing, and from where we are writing. And that's the thing that we also have to protect, because like often we are told by law enforcement or by the government that metadata doesn't say so much about you, and they only need it like if terrorists like connect to other terrorists and they have to find them. But in the reality we can derive a lot of metadata, and metadata is sometimes like as telling as much about us as like the content of our communication. Like you can imagine if you have like phone calls to different kind of doctors or like different kind of like self-help groups, that there's like a lot of content about you, like why should you connect to those people. Another thing that is let out in many human rights documents is like the protection from surveillance and like the protection from unlawful surveillance. And we have a principle that says like the citizens of a state are generally not under general suspicion. That means like you can't intercept the calls of anyone, because if there is no concrete suspicion and the surveillance is not necessary or proportionate, that means you could like investigate with other means, it shouldn't be done. It originally really should only be used when you try to fight serious crimes and you have a suspicion that a person is involved in that serious crime. And like the UN resolution from 2013, where they made like a document of a human rights in the digital age, was also saying that like if we are in fear of surveillance of ourselves, then we are also like hindered in our right to free speech and expression. Because of course, if you have the feeling, even if you are not, to be surveilled, you will have like a chilling effect that you try to not stand out from like a normal person, or not be like in suspicion by anything you're doing, and to behave like more like what is expected of you, or at least what you think the state expects of you, like of a like good citizen. Then there's another principle like connected to letters and information, and information that goes about us, and that's like the principle of informational self-determination that was ruled out by the German Federal Constitution Court, which at some point in 1983, you have to note, said like, there is so much data processing capabilities now more than ever, so we have to give a person the right or the capability of determining what personal information this person gives out. We had the census in the time in Germany that meant like people had to like answer questions about themselves to like get how many people are living in a city, to get what is the social structure of a city, and many people protested against that and were quite successful with this ruling of the Constitutional Court, which also meant like a new understanding of our communication or about the information of ourselves in the digital world. And then I want to start with electricity supply. You may ask why I'm doing this, and I say electricity supply is the same as like the access to public transport and the access to water and the access to like a health support system. And these are all like things that are in our daily lives and then we expect to be there. And like a thing we also expect to be there is internet access. That means we are using the internet every day and we need the access to the internet to participate in society. And that is deriving like an access to internet and information right, which was also ruled out by a court in Germany, that everybody has the essential right to internet of central significance, because people can't participate in society anymore without like accessing the internet. Even like pupils in school, like in elementary school, need the internet to do research, to do like little tasks on the internet. It's widely used, and if someone doesn't have internet at home, then they are really, really impeded by participating. We have this ruling in Germany 2013, but we also have former rulings or legislation approaches by other countries which are far more ahead. Like we have in Finland a legal right to broadband access, and this was also ruled by a court, and in 2010, that means 10 years before, they said everybody should have this access. And we have to also to see that in Finland it's much more difficult, or it should be much more difficult, to guarantee that right than in Germany, because like you see like the citizenship of Finland is more distributed and there are more far off places, while in Germany we have quite a dense network of infrastructure. And so Germany is still in the backfield of this broadband access term. Another right that is connected to the internet is to have an internet that everybody can access equally. That means we need net neutrality. What is net neutrality? Net neutrality is the principle that every point of the network can connect to any other point in the network, free from discrimination, and free from discrimination based on the type of the data, of the origin of the data, the destination of the data. That means no matter what you're doing on the internet, it should come like in the same speed like anything other. So there should not be any priorities between like music streaming or getting your emails. And we also have to note that like this access to internet is one of the success stories to the internet. So it got possible to really put a lot of our daily lives into the internet, and to transport like the civil rights movement to the internet, and to give them the opportunity to spread and to spread their word to people which normally wouldn't be able to participate, like people in some villages which can't like afford to go to digital rights movements meetings or to demonstrations so often because they have to go there. So now they have a way to participate no matter where they are and no matter what they are doing. Connected to this, of course, that everybody can access the internet, and is the freedom of speech, because the freedom of speech is a very essential right on the internet because anyone can post anything, and that gives people the opportunity to connect with other people who have like the same opinion and to form movements to fight for their opinion. But like what I was talking about sounds all quite positive, that it's like the rights we have and they are all set out in some legislation, and the thing is, why do we have now to be afraid that our rights are threatened? So in original times the internet was built kind of an utopia of freedom. The internet should be equal for everyone, the internet should be accessible for everyone, we should have the same rights in the internet, but nowadays we have some agencies or government institutions which want to threaten our privacy on the internet and our equality on the internet. Like we've seen in the last 2 years since the revelations of Edward Snowden that the secret and intelligence agencies of the world are totally out of control and totally going crazy collecting data about us. They built like a worldwide communication spying web, and they even spy on states and on state like representatives, like presidents or like officers of some agencies, and there is a total imbalance of power because like even among the states there is like really strong dependencies, so that states accept that other states spy on them. Like we've seen this in Germany recently, there was like press reports about economy espionage of Germany by the NSA and like helping them to spy on some companies in Germany or in Europe, and like the German government should find out like what selectors they used to do that, or what selectors they used to target companies or people. And they had a discussion with the German government if they could give them to the parliamentary inquiries, and like the USA until now rejected this, and the German government is kind of just accepting it because they say if you like stop your cooperation with us, you will be the one that has really disadvantages and not we, because we are not dependent on you, you are dependent on us, and so we can do what we want. We also have like on the German level really threats to our privacy. Like just some month ago the German government decided to introduce a new form of data retention. That means that all our metadata is collected of our communications. That means whom we write emails to, from when we are logged in our smartphones, which websites we access, which phone calls we make, which, like, yeah, everything basically. And that is really kind of ridiculous because 1 year ago, the European Court of Justice had a ruling that data retention is illegal. That was the European guidelines, but the European guidelines were like necessary for states to implement. Germany refused to do that before, so the data retention in Germany was once rejected by the court, but nowadays they really say like, yeah, we want to have it again because we needed to fight against terrorists, we needed we needed to fight against serious crime. But we also see that they don't only use it to fight serious crime as we would expect serious crime to be, they also want to fight it like internet fraud or like spam emails or people that are distributing viruses, and that is not serious crime. Serious crime you can refer to as murder or something like that. Another thing is that we don't only have like governmental surveillance, we also have like surveillance by companies or big corporate organizations that want to have our data to make money of it. A problem with that is that we use a lot of free services on the internet, and we're kind of happy about those free services on the internet because, yeah, why should I pay for an email account if I can have it on Google Mail for free at as many as I want? And that is also why people kind of accepted to give their data to services, because they said we can't avoid it. There was a Eurobarometer on the opinion of privacy and data protection among the citizens of the European Union, and they ask people like, how do you feel the control over your data? Do you have the impression that you can control what data is there in the world about you, or what data services have about you? And like 50% of people said they believe they have no control at all. Like in Germany it was even 75%, which could like be because in Germany the Snowden revelation press reporting was much bigger than other companies, and Germany has quite a strong background in data protection. another thing of corporate surveillance is that they all tell us they will be, yeah, they will care of our data. They have terms of services which sound kind of nice. So we won't give your data to third parties. We won't use your data for anything that you don't want to. They do a transparency campaign. They tell us like if they give our data to law enforcement agencies or what they do. But in the end, we really don't know what happens because we experience a lot too often that they have those terms of services, but in the end they do something totally else. Maybe they just say, yeah, we made the data pseudonymous, so we can't really refer from the data to your person. But we all know that pseudonymous data is not really pseudonymous or anonymous like they want to tell us, but you can really derive who it was if you have enough data of this and you just like combine the data. To fight this data protection problems, the EU decided like to do a new data protection regulation, and they are debating at the moment, so we are in the last round of discussions, and the consistency of the privacy in the member states should be guaranteed. But we just see that a lot of companies or corporate players are lobbying massively against the data protection guidelines, and they want to weaken it wherever they can. And unfortunately, like in the previous round of debate, we had the debate in the Council of the EU, and in the Council of the EU, many amendments of the data protection regulations came through which were quite privacy unfriendly and really company friendly. So we have to hope and we have to do our best to fight it in the last rounds and to get more data protection into the regulation again. Another problem we have with net neutrality is this nice commissioner, Günther Oettinger, we all love and laugh about. And he's really like a lobbyist trend. So all his meetings are with big lobbyists, with big like economy organizations, and so he suddenly like made clear that he thinks net neutrality is not net neutrality, and you have to give some fast lanes to special services. And he is always giving us a stupid example with self-driving cars. So he says, like, if car manufacturers don't have like super fast lanes on the internet which are prioritized and eventually hinder your internet traffic, then that should be, because otherwise the self-driving cars will crash into each other or crash into a tree or whatever. And like a funny thing about this, that some German press platform asked like the car manufacturers, like, is he right? Is he really like saying, do you really need internet for your cars, for your self-driving cars? And nobody responded besides BMW, and they said no. Like, you can't rely on the internet because the internet inherently isn't stable at any point, and so we just like use like telecommunications between the cars, and we would never rely on the internet, so we don't even need the internet. That's like telling us like how this guy is investigating what he's telling about. So we just like have the impression that he has like a paper with a speech of a lobbyist, just reading it and believing the lobbyist, or just pretending to believe the lobbyist and getting his opinion through. Another thing that doesn't go ideal with the access to internet is that in Germany we have a principle that's breach of duty of care. That means in German Störerhaftung, which you might know better, and that hinders like people from providing their free Wi-Fi to other people, because like the government until now is of the opinion that you are responsible for the infringements other people do with your internet connection. That means if they download something wrong, you are the responsible person. Even if you just provide your Wi-Fi to others and you don't even know about it, that just leads to some funny consequences. They made like a proposition for a law change that said like, yeah, you can do it, but you have to know the names of the persons, but you don't have to keep a protocol of the names of the persons. So this protocol is only there when they are doing it. And after you forget this, that tells us really much about how the government understands those issues, like not at all. So Germany is really antiquated on that. So you might notice if you go to other European countries, which like have not like the image of being so developed, like if you go to the Ukraine, then you have free Wi-Fi basically everywhere. And even when I was in India at the beginning of the year, you had free Wi-Fi on every fucking rail station, if it's in a like slightly larger village. And another like really point where the German government has to get up with the European Union is like the access to broadband. Like in Germany they say, yeah, we are planning it, and we are planning it to do with the telecommunications companies, And like the result of this is that they do it like really friendly for the telecommunications companies, so where they are kind of cheating around and saying, yeah, you can have fast internet over LTE, like, but then you only have fast internet if you're the only one in the phone cell and you are quite near behind the radio mast. Then of course we experience censorship everywhere, especially in authoritarian regimes, and we kind of have to be ashamed because the surveillance technology or the censorship technology used by those countries is often widely made in Germany. And there we have like a responsibility which isn't noticed by the government in total, so we have this dual use problem that if we made software or hardware to surveil people and the German companies say like, yeah, we only give it to nice regimes, like to nice countries we know, to European countries where we can export, like with knowing that they won't do any bad with that, but in the end all those software and hardware appears in those countries and they say, yeah, we don't know how it happened. And like, to conclude this talk, the internet gives us a vast amount of possibilities to violate human rights that we saw, because it's quite easy to violate human rights on a large scale. That is one thing that is different from the world we know before, because there the surveillance capabilities without the ability to process a lot of data were kind of limited, because the processing time it needed was too long and it would be too expensive to surveil like every citizen in the world. And now we see that the more computing power they have, the more storage capabilities they have, they will expand the surveillance to like a point where it's really not possible to defend against it. But we also have to say that the internet gives us a vast amount of possibilities to fight for human rights and for defending human rights. We saw this like in the Arab Spring when Facebook was used to coordinate the protests, even if we don't like Facebook here, of course, but there it was a means of communication, which was also a bit difficult because over Facebook you could trace the people a lot better, like that was also used against them, but this was really a platform to coordinate and to get together and to get people from different backgrounds together, which maybe wouldn't have gone to any protests alone when they wouldn't know that there are other people choosing, joining them, and there's really a large crowd to protest against governments. Another thing we have to see is that cryptography is still working. That means we can defend against surveillance, at least we can try to defend against surveillance if there aren't backdoors in the program we are using. We have like PGP for encrypting emails, we have Tor for browsing the web anonymously, we have the surveillance and the secret agencies who try to circumvent those tools and to try to put backdoors in there or to find means to make them like ineffective. But we know that they have problems with intercepting Tor, or they have problems with like breaking PGP for our email encryption. And we have also a lot of tools for circumventing censorship, that means also Tor, but also other proxies or virtual private network tools. And that can help people in those regimes to communicate in a confidential way and to communicate and to see the internet as it should be. Because this breach of the freedom of speech and association and net neutrality is really, really massive for those people. So the message I want to give you is fight for your digital rights with the matters you can. That doesn't have to mean that you have to lobby against those big corporations. That also can mean that you explain to your friends or to your relatives how to use email encryption. That also means that you can write letters to the parliamentarians in Germany or in other states and tell them that you don't want to have those restrictive rules or this oppression, and that they have to read your emails. We know that, we did that a lot of time, and it's much more effective than you would think. So some of the parliamentarians in the EU Parliament also told us they are quite happy about that, not only those big corporate lobbyists with their nice presence are coming and getting on their nerves. So that's what I want to say. Be political, fight for your digital rights. You can read our blog if you're interested. We try to publish a lot. We try to publish something in English in the last time. We don't have always the capacities, but we try to at least cover the topics which are really internationally relevant in English also. And if you want to reach me, like, you can read the blog and find articles of me. You can write me to anna@netzpolitik.org. That's my PGP fingerprint, or you can somehow contact me on Twitter. Thank you.
There are already possibilities to have a free Wi-Fi via Freifunk. It's a regional community, decentralized, and the main website is www.freifunk.net, and it's in almost every town in Germany, maybe in other countries too soon.
Yeah, Freifunk is fantastic, and if there's not one in your town, you should find out about how to start one and join that community. Thank you.
Yeah, but I want to make just one short remark to this. We also see like Freifunk threatened in Germany, because like they say if you have more than 9,000 users in the network, you have to implement some surveillance capacities, and there's a big discussion going on now with the agency responsible for like all this telecommunication stuff. And they say, yeah, you have to do this, and so a lot of Freifunk initiatives are really like in danger of needing to implement something which they don't want and wouldn't do. So even for this, we have to fight that it can stay and can expand.
Hi. Could you maybe repeat some of the tools we can use to protect our privacy and tell what each of them does?
Okay. Yeah, like one of the main tools for me is like GnuPG for using email encryption. That you will, yeah, if you Google email encryption, you will find it quite instantly. So that's really a tool. The problem with the tool is that like the part you are communicating with also has to have this tool installed. So it's always a two-sided thing, but it's always good to try to explain it to other people if you want to understand it. Like I saw that in the last 2 years where I'm at netzpolitik.org, like at the beginning I got like I think 10% of encrypted emails, and if I'm now looking into my personal inbox, it's on some days it's even 60%. So there's a big shift, and there are always more people you can communicate with, and that shouldn't stop.
Thanks. I just wanted to say the last NetPolitical talk here from Linus and Fiona is also going to focus on real practical advice for different kind of encryption tools and anonymity tools.
And like one thing maybe to say is that if you search for those tools by yourself, like if you want to see what's around, for me it's always really important that those tools are open source, because if we don't have open source tools, then we can't rely on the tools not having backdoors. We also can't do this if it's open source, but at least we have the possibility to detect this. That's also why we need more people capable of doing this, looking into the software and looking into the source code, to support the people to really audit the source code and see that there are no security flaws or loopholes.
One more question here.
Die Übersetzung läuft noch. Ich möchte gerne mal fragen, und das wird dann sicherlich auch in anderen Vorträgen noch weiter erläutert, aber mir kommt jetzt die Frage auf, was für ein Programm du nutzt. Also es gibt ja die Linux-Programme, es gibt ja die freien Betriebssysteme, und ja, da wollte ich jetzt einfach mal wissen, welche man da so wirklich empfehlen kann.
Okay, he was asking like which programs I'm using. Like, as I said, like the most daily program I use is like GnuPG, and then I'm using OTR for instant messaging that you can do with different instant messaging protocols, and it's quite easy because you just have to install it and then it goes quite automatically if your counterpart also has this plugin installed. And I'm using Tor if I want to browse the internet, so that's for anonymity and for also more confidentiality. And what else am I using? I'm using TextSecure and ChatSecure on my smartphone, though that's also a very easy possibility to communicate encrypted, because it's just an app you have to install and then you can communicate with your counterpart. So everybody with a smartphone is capable of doing that without any problems in general. What else am I using? My operating system is just like a common Ubuntu Linux.
Okay, we have one last question back here.
Hello, thanks for your interesting talk. I don't know if you addressed this earlier in the talk, but I'd like to hear your opinion about the new internet satellite constellations being pursued by such companies as Google or SpaceX. Are you familiar with the subject?
Yeah, kind of.
Does this pose new threats concerning privacy or
I don't think this especially, like, one problem we have with all those big companies applying infrastructure like Google is that they are kind of centralized, and so we have to be aware that the more centralization and the more things companies do, like not only providing services but also providing infrastructure or internet access, are a threat to not only privacy but to the net neutrality feature we should have.
Strategy of vertical integration, it's when you have everything out of one hand, from the infrastructure down to the operating system and the applications. Of course, yeah, it's all in one hand, so that poses a risk in itself. And then those kind of mobile infrastructures like balloons or drones, of course, also have a risk in them, because it's maybe one thing to push a button and say fly away internet that way than to dig up cables from the ground. So yeah. Okay, I think that's all we have time for now. Let's have another really big round of applause for the first speaker, Anna.